Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. As most of our listeners are well aware, Southwest Florida recently experienced two severe harmful algal blooms, the red tide along the coast and the toxic blue-green algae in the Caloosahatchee River and its estuary. Both blooms were at least partly fueled by nutrient-rich water from Lake Okeechobee, but there is no doubt that the lake was the source of the toxic blue-green algae. Now, there's a new research effort underway to monitor algae in Lake Okeechobee using a self-driving, solar-powered, data-collecting sailboat called NAV2. It was used in 2017 to collect information on the red tide bloom, and now it's been launched in Lake Okeechobee to collect data there. Joining us to explain how it works, what kinds of information it collects, and what researchers hope to do with all that data is Dr. Jordan Beckler. He is Assistant Research Professor and Director of the Geochemistry and Geochemical Sensing Lab at Florida Atlantic University's Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute. He's leading this study. Dr. Beckler, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm absolutely excited to be here.
We're also joined by one of the people who invented this small self-sailing research vessel. Scott Duncan is the president of NAVOcean. Scott, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks. Also very excited to be on the show, so it's great to have a chance to say a few things.
Great. Let's dig in. But first, I want to invite our listeners to give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK if you have any questions. So before I get to the algae data it's collecting, I want to hear about this little sailboat. Scott, I understand you basically invented this with a little team in a garage.
Yeah, that's about right. Some fairly humble beginnings, and with a long-time old friend of mine from went to school together a long time ago, Ethan Artunian, and I got started on this some number of years ago. And just through really inspiration and some blood, sweat, and tears, we strapped the development of this autonomous surface vehicle technology.
So is your background in autonomous vehicles?
Well, I actually have a degree more in history and Japanese language.
Oh, well, that makes sense. Of course.
It's a sharp turn coming out of college. It went a different direction with small boat building and design, and my development partner, Ethan, has a background in electrical engineering and software.
All right. So it's kind of like a waterborne drone is what we're dealing with here.
It really is, yeah. And sometimes drone creates the vision for people of, you know, quadcopters flying around in the air. So we've taken to calling it other things, like sometimes it's called a self-navigating miniboat. Or a self-navigating sailboat. So it's really a type of autonomous surface vehicle, we call it, in the industry.
So then did you build this little guy with the intent of having it collect data?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was part of the deal from the beginning.
It was, yeah. We wanted to see, the inspiration got started to see, gee, could we make a very small sailboat? We're looking at a little model of a sailboat. What could we do if we automated something like that? Could we make it go across an ocean, or how far could it go? And that idea very quickly evolved to, wait a minute, this would be really useful and amazing if we could get something to go long duration, long distance, sustainably without running out of gas. So we got rid of the gasoline and went for sail, wind and solar power instead.
So Dr. Beckler, I'm going to turn to you now. When did this little solar-powered research sailboat come across your radar?
Well... Scott and friends, they came into our lives, I think it was back in late 2015 or 2016. I was at my previous institution over there on the West Coast at Moat Marine Lab in Sarasota, and Scott reached out and said that they had this cool little device, this cool little drone, and we were already doing some work with underwater drones or buoyancy gliders. We were actively surveying the red tide bloom every few weeks. And we said, wow, well, this could actually be a really cool combination, putting algae sensors on this boat. There's a lot of advantages, some disadvantages with respect to vehicles that can go underwater, but, you know, it all depends on your purpose. So Scott reached out and offered to do a demonstration, and we worked with him to get some algae sensors on the boat as well as some environmental sensors. And we did a test deployment back in December 2017. We caught the really early beginnings of the red tide bloom that's been plaguing you guys up until just a couple weeks ago, I believe.
Yeah, it's only just recently that it's kind of died down a little bit. But I just – so what kind of sensors do you have on there? You said you have algae sensors and then other environmental sensors. What are you checking things out for? Are you looking at what kind of nutrients are in the water surrounding these algae spots or –
Well, that would be really powerful. Right now, nutrient sensors aren't really all there, especially if we're trying to think about, nutrient sensors that could be miniaturized and put on an AUV. The selection is rather limited. So more so, we're looking in this case at CTD, which is conductivity, temperature, and depth, or salinity and depth, essentially. So that can tell us, temperature, which is probably the single most important variable. Other things like salinity can tell us if there's rain inputs or freshwater inputs if we're dealing with a saltwater coastal site. The boat has atmospheric sensors. Obviously, it has a wind sensor, right? It needs to know which way to point its sails, where to go. As far as looking at the algae, we have a three-channel fluorometer made by a company called Turner Designs, and it has a chlorophyll A channel, so that's chlorophyll A is a pigment that's expressed highly in most phytoplankton. It has a phycocyanin sensor. That's a pigment specific for freshwater or in freshwater algae.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, CDOM, which is colored dissolved organic matter. That's the tannins that are in the water. So that's kind of a measure of light availability to the organisms. Lots of other things as well that CDOM does, but that's probably the most important. And then we also have a backscatter sensor on there, and that measures the particulates in the water. And so that can tell us, at least looking at the different channels on this single backscatter sensor, we can sort of get an understanding if we have phytoplankton cells or just generic detritus in the water, the composition of the particulates. And especially if we're going to combine the fluorometer data with the backscatter data, that can really help us actually identify phytoplankton, perhaps even at the species level.
Wow. So this collects all this data. Are you able to see that information in real time?
Yeah. Here I have to thank our friends at GCOOS. They're the Gulf of Mexico Coastal Ocean Observing System. I should say first that the sailboat does transmit the data in real time via a satellite connection to the iPhone app or the iPad app that used to control it. But GCOOS, the organization, they host data from all different sensors in the Gulf of Mexico. They have a really informative website. It's pretty user-friendly as well, and you could actually see in real time the track of the sailboat using this website specifically. It's called Gandalf.
Oh, that's great.
The creator is a Lord of the Rings fan. So, you can actually go there right now, and you could see the track of the sailboat. It created a really beautiful star-shaped pattern across the lake. And if you click on the individual points, you can get measurements of chlorophyll. And actually, I believe the data points are colored, like they're more of a dark green if you have more chlorophyll. So you could kind of see a spatial map of the chlorophyll the last time we did the deployment in the lake a couple weeks ago.
I just want to make sure that you're aware that we have a lot of armchair scientists in our part of the world ever since these algae blooms have come out. So you're going to have a lot of people wanting to check that out. And
that's
come
fantastic.
It's amazing what the callers call in with questions, and they're normal, regular old Joes, but they're talking about serious scientific things. So I think that this will probably be very popular, and you'll probably have a lot of traffic on this site. You mentioned that it's sending up satellites. So how big is this boat, Scott?
It's about 6 feet long, and it's about the sail and the mast stick up about 6 feet above the ocean surface or the water surface, and so it's pretty small. And in fact, it's our specialty is trying to make a vehicle that's very small and lightweight, because that way it's not hazardous. If it was to get bumped into, it's designed to lose in the case of a collision, and so by being very small, let's pack on some. Just a certain amount of solar power and a certain amount of batteries, so the data, the electronic energy efficiency and all is something that we're working on. It can send out, it has lots of electronic equipment on board. So it has an Iridium satellite modem, and it sends out data from the sensors and its location as well. It can send that in real time to shore, so you can see it actually on a chart or a map on a computer.
So are you kind of keeping an eye on are you kind of keeping an eye on it, though? Like, what if a storm develops? Are you going to have to take down the sail remotely, or does it know how to do that?
Well, it's built really tough, is the approach that we took. So that's a really good question, because we thought long and hard about possibilities of being able to furl the sail in the sail area. And the approach that we came up with is to use a cloth sail instead of a hard sail. We just use good old-fashioned cloth. Well, it's actually the new kind of Dacron that's really super tough. A little better than the Phoenicians, but if you go back 2,000 years, you know, it's really the same technology applied with new twist technology-wise applied today, and it's super tough. So in the advent of a storm, it's designed to be able to ride that out and hold position well enough so that it can twist ashore or something like that.
You kind of cut out there a little bit, but from what I'm gathering from what you just said, it's a cloth sail, just like back in the old days, but with different, better materials. It's a little bit tougher. Dr. Beckler,
yeah, Julie, if I could just add, we did a shorter test deployment before this past deployment in Lake Okeechobee in the Banana River over here, which is it's really not so much a river more as it is just the Indian River Lagoon here that covers 40% of the east coast of Florida. And when we did it, there was actually like what we deployed in 30 knot winds coming from the north, and we deployed at the south end of the Banana River, and the boat was actually able to tack upstream despite these winds. In fact, you know, the winds kind of help it out. It was that's one of my favorite parts of this boat, is the ability for it to actually get to a waypoint regardless of it even being upstream. And we actually recorded winds in excess of 50 knots at night. So it's pretty tough.
It sounds like a tough little guy. So is the goal to be able to predict when harmful algal blooms are developing or to look for patterns? What do you want to learn from this?
Yeah, so you know, there's a few different reasons why we're doing this. The first one probably just being able to rapidly detect a bloom. There's a lot of advantages of using this boat versus other techniques like satellites. Again, you know, all these techniques have their value. This one is great for telling you what is in the water at that specific moment in time. You know, by knowing where the algae bloom is, you could mitigate effects. So whether they be like locally in the bloom or lake wide, provide warnings to the public about drinking water, boating, fishing, irrigation. We could potentially inform releases of water downstream instead of, let's say, just like relocating the problem to Stuart or Fort Myers. You know, folks can consider where the bloom is at the exact time before they release the water.
I guess like knowing where the bloom is within the lake could have some kind of an impact on decisions on when to release water.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. You know, we're scientists, so actually trying to tell people what to do in that regards isn't really my job or my forte. I just try and give them the information they need to best do their job. But from a scientific perspective, though, it can tell us, for instance, where the blooms are popping up. So, like, are they popping up near the edges of the lake, perhaps near like Taylor Creek in the north end of the lake? And one of our collaborators on the project, Dr. Bill Lauda here at FAU, he's also looking to see if there might be like septic tank inputs of nutrients. So, do the blooms start in the north end of the lake? You know, we don't really know this. Do the blooms start after you have, say, periods of wind coming from a certain direction, and the winds are upwelling the bottom nutrient-rich waters, especially like after the summertime when you have the sediments, they're really incubating and releasing a lot of nutrients, and now they just need some driving force to really vertically mix them to bring those nutrients to the surface to where the phytoplankton could use them.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could imagine this little boat, this little 6-foot boat, uncovering information that would completely shock you. What kind of a thing could it find that would just completely blow your mind?
Ooh, I don't know. That's a tough one. Go ahead, Scott.
I know this. I know that Jordan, being a scientist, has to be cautious about that question, because scientists are good about that and jumping to conclusions. But being a boat guy, I feel like I can see, you know, one of the visions is that long-term, long-duration data collection over time reveals information that you just don't know. You don't know for sure what it's going to be, but what you do know is you don't know everything, and that there are important things that we can learn from. And I think it was so Dr. Bill Lauda said, you know, put it really well to saying that, you know, there are times when algae blooms take place and grow in a huge way, like in 2018. And then in 2017, there really wasn't a huge growth. And why? And trying to nail down the factors, the very complicated factors that set off a bloom or that don't, could have really big implications about the best way to mitigate the algae blooms and put in measures to solve the problem.
And also trend data, that would be really useful as well. What is the current situation out there at the lake? Is there algae? Are you getting reports from your boat about algae in certain spots?
Yeah, so the boat, so I don't know if you realize, but the deployment is actually over. It ended about a week ago. You know, just to kind of report on how it did, it traveled really well. It made, as I mentioned earlier, a couple of star-shaped patterns around mm-hmm. the lake. And we do this special pattern. It's really neat because it allows us to survey the edges of the lake, but also kind of cross the lake. And it's a really great balance of surveying, I guess, the center of the lake, where you really want to collect a lot of data points, but then also getting to the edges relatively frequently. We did have a lot of success, like with we ground truthed the sensors, so we followed the boat along and we actually collected samples right next to where the boat was taking samples, and sure enough, the boat detected higher chlorophyll exactly where we detected higher chlorophyll in these samples when we analyzed them back in the lab.
That's kind of a good idea if you kind of micromanaged it.
Absolutely, yeah.
To make sure it's doing
kind
it right,
of surprising,
right?
Yeah, you know, what was really surprising to us is we had put the backscatter sensor, we borrowed it from a colleague here, and it was actually designed for use in the ocean, so really dilute particle counts. And unfortunately, the sensor was completely saturated. The signal was completely saturated the entire time, and it's really interesting when you think, because when we were out there, and I didn't even realize this, it's in a way it's a little embarrassing because I'm a scientist, but I didn't realize that a couple decades ago the lake was completely crystal clear, and they said you could see 15 feet all the way to the bottom of the lake, and it was blue water and everything. And here now the water was so turbid that, you know, you can't see more than 10 centimeters in, and it was saturating our backscatter sensor. I guess as far as the algae bloom, what folks really want to know, we didn't measure any really high chlorophyll counts, not like how we did in the Banana River a week prior to the Lake Okeechobee deployment. In the Banana River, we know we have an ongoing Oreombra bloom.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brown tide bloom. Our colleague, Dr. Bill Lauda, he didn't measure any indication of microcystis, the common blue-green algae that everybody's concerned about, but we did notice that there was a floating green slick on the surface, and everybody's first instinct is to assume that it's microcystis, but in fact, it was actually Anabaena, a species called Anabaena, and that was confirmed twice now. In two sets of samples on two different days through two different techniques, and I think it's been observed on the lake before, and it does produce a toxin. We don't know if it's actively producing a toxin now.
I'm sitting here going, oh man, Anabaena, now I have to look that one up and figure it out. Is that one that we should be concerned about?
I honestly couldn't tell you. I know that it does produce saxitoxin, which can cause paralytic shellfish poisoning, but I'm not so much on the health side of things. So,
well, I'll look it up.
I can't tell you that much.
I'm no scientist, but you know I'm going to look it up just like all the rest of us do over here. So, Scott, what's on the horizon for NavOcean? Is there a NAV3 in development?
Good question. Right now we're focusing more on sort of a next iteration of our NAV2 vehicle. And in the past, we've done one that we call the NAV3. Believe it or not, we did one in the past. And we called the NAV3 because it was bigger. It was about 3 meters long. And But we've kind of gone in the direction of the smaller vehicle because the smaller, lightweight, easier to handle, easy to land and launch. And those factors are just so important that we're specializing in that direction. And we're very excited about the next generation of this vehicle, which will be able to go out even longer and be even stronger and tougher and sail even better and more importantly, even deploy, integrate to it even more data collection sensors.
Well, we are out of time, unfortunately, because I could sit here and talk for a long time about this subject, so I think it really is very fascinating. But that's all the time we have for the show. But I want to thank my guest, Scott Duncan, president of NavOcean. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Also, Dr. Jordan Beckler is the director of the Geochemistry and Geochemical Sensing Lab at Florida Atlantic University's Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute. Dr. Beckler, thanks so much to you as well.
Anytime, Julie. It was so much fun to be here.
And also, stay in touch with your progress as you keep going forward.
You bet. Feel free to email me.
We will. And thanks to my earlier guests, Carrie Riedel from Salus Care and Mark Fontaine from the Florida Alcohol and Drug Abuse Association. If you tuned in to our show today and you'd like to hear it in its entirety, visit our website, gulfcoastlive.org. And remember, you can also hear our full episodes by subscribing to Gulf Coast Live on iTunes, NPR One, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO, Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.